ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For the first time in over 50 years, astronauts will soon fly around the moon.
They're ready to fly.
But there are real concerns about their safety.
We're playing Russian roulette.
In our series, The Challenger Legacy, we trace the history of two space shuttle disasters. And we ask, what are the lessons for today?
I'm Karl Kuschelnitsky.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Binge all the episodes now. Just search for The Challenger Legacy on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
We've never had more freedom, so why are we so anxious, lonely, and angry? Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. It's the panel show about the things we believe. And in the 21st century, the belief in freedom may well trump belief in God. These days, we want rights, not religion, choice, not church, pleasure over prayer. And in Australia, and increasingly around the world, the market is the messiah and the self is the saviour. But if we're the freest people who've ever lived on the earth, free to choose our partners, our careers, our genders, our gods or no god, free to buy anything, stream anything, be anything, why then do we seem to be unravelling in a world of loneliness, anxiety, extremism and polarisation? The more we chase freedom, the more it seems to slip away. Well, today on God Forbid, is freedom itself the trap? We have two fine authors who disagree with each other in two fine books. Max Jagannathan is Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity, author of The Freedom Trap, and Alex Lefebvre is Professor of Politics and Philosophy at the University of Sydney. His book, Liberalism as a Way of Life, both in the Sydney studio. Hey, Alex.
Hey.
Hello, Max.
G'day.
So, Max, you open your book presciently with this viral video out of Iran, an old man dancing at his market stall in Tehran. What is it about that image?
Yeah, well, I think obviously it's kind of newly relevant given the headlines and what's happening right now, which I certainly didn't see coming in the way that it's played out. But the reason I mentioned that clip of this Iranian, I think he was a taxi driver dancing outside a fish market, and it went viral, was because dancing in public is prohibited in Iran. And so that really just kind of reflected the longing for freedom that's on every human heart. Alex actually speaks to this a lot in his book about that, that the universality of some of these moral principles and ethical values, and freedom, I think, is one of them, which is why a conversation about liberalism is so important.
But you call that an old freedom as distinct from new freedom. What's the difference?
Yeah, and you know, that dichotomy, the freedoms of thought, speech, conscience, the freedom of having a say in who governs you and those sorts of things. I refer to them as old freedom, but I kind of left it at that point and pivoted to freedom in the private sphere. And so the rest of my book was really about private freedom, for want of a better term, the freedom to, you know, live stream and to shop and to choose our partners, and how we kind of mediate that classical kind of freedom that the fathers and mothers of liberalisms took to a political place, how we actually make that real and play that out in our own lives.
Alex, Max is describing liberalism. What does it mean for you?
An easy question to start. So everyone has their own private definition of liberalism, but if you go back to the origins of the word, it means a couple of things. So it's an old Latin word, and it means, on the one hand, a state of being free. So the freedom bit that we're going to talk about a ton, but also being generous. So in English, we encode these words with liberty on the one hand, freedom, and then liberality on the other hand, generosity. And I think the ethic of liberalism at both an individual level, but also at a collective level, is to try as best we can to reconcile those two tendencies. And a lovely word that we have in English is fairness, that tries to bridge those two. So giving freedom to all, but also managing opportunities for everyone to be able to do that.
Isn't everyone a liberal?
That's a softball question for me if I ever heard one. Listen, I think we live in liberal times, and I think ideals of freedom in particular that we're going to talk about, whether or not they are entrapping, surround us 24/7. So that when if a young person wants to go on the romantic market, what do? They pick up their phone, they swipe right, swipe left. My kid is in year 12 right now, and that's utterly on her as to what she's going to do. So this idea that liberal ideas engulf us is the main metaphor of my own book, which is that liberalism is the water we swim in. And I think that's exactly what Max is encountering and pushing back on, and I think in many helpful ways.
And when we say liberalism or liberal, it's often in Australia, we use the term small L liberal, so it's not the Liberal Party. But political liberalism is the idea that, am I right, choice about one's life, the state has no role. Who I love, these kind of things.
Correct. Yeah, one of the core principles of later liberalism is that the state does not officially endorse any particular way of life as better or worse than others. So if you want to get married, go get married. If you don't want to stay single, that's fine too. You want to go day drink at Bondi, barring regulations of Waverley Council, you can do that.
Well, this was your anecdote that you began your book with. Max had the taxi driver illegally dancing in Iran. You spent Christmas Day at Coogee Beach singing drunken carols amid 16 tons of rubbish, none of which you created or imbibed.
Okay, this needs a little setup. So from my voice, you'll hear that I'm not from around here. I'm Canadian. And in 2010, I moved here with my wife. We kept on moving, traveling back to Canada for Christmas. But at one point in 2016, we were fed up. It was getting expensive. We're like, why don't we just stay here? So we went down to the beach for a welcome novelty, which was Christmas in full summer, which for a Canadian is just an unimaginable thing. And we went down and it was a party the size I had never seen. It was just bodies on bodies, beer on beer, as like a vanishing horizon of flesh. And it was fun. We had a good time. We hung out. But then it got me to reflect, like, where the hell am I? And the joke I make, which is only half a joke, actually, I don't think it's a joke, is that Sydney is the most godless place I've ever lived in my life. And I don't mean that it's like depraved or wicked. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean that in important respects, I think it is a God-absent place in which religion for many people is no longer a central reference or even a remembered moral framework, and something else has taken its place. And I want to say it's liberalism that is a child of Christianity, but it's non-theistic.
You're a liberal, may I ask?
On my good days, yeah, I try to be.
And you described the beach situation as the funnest part of hell.
Yep.
And it was liberalism on steroids, completely everyone free to do the good, the bad, and the ugly. But the people there had no idea that it was liberalism that was shaping them. I mean, and still, I'm not so sure how it was either.
That's it. So the opening of the book is a joke, and it's an old joke by famous 21st century author, David Foster Wallace, and it's the parable of the three fish. So there's two young fish swimming along, and they're just happy-go-lucky fish, and then they encounter an old fish on their way, and the old fish says, "Hey, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish kind of look at each other, swim along, and then one of them says to the other, "What the hell is water?" And the joke I make is that adapted to our times, the old fish would be asking, "How's the liberalism?" And the young fish, who are these partiers at Coogee, for example, would see saying, "What the hell is liberalism?" So I ask students in my class all the time, who here is not religious? And at University of Sydney, 80% of students put up their hand for that. And then my next question is basically, where do you get your moral framework from? Because I don't know if there's a God-sized hole in our heart, but I do know there's a God-sized hole in our culture. And in the absence of a religious framework, something's going to take its place. Morality abhors a vacuum. Something's going to rush in. And my gambit, and I think Max agrees with me here, though he doesn't have as positive an interpretation of it, is that liberalism is what's taking that place.
And you call yourself a liberal. May I ask, are you a non-religious liberal?
I am non-theistic. I'm a liberal. The idea is that liberalism provides my main moral framework, and that I use not just to navigate political stuff, but also family life, how I raise my kid, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, Max, you do have God in your life. However, you do see that society has replaced God with liberalism. It just says you don't happen to be a liberal, unlike Alex. Have I got this right?
So not quite. This is an interesting one, James, and I'm glad you asked it like that. I'm definitely with him. I'm an enormous supporter of liberalism. I actually think it is the best form of organizing our governance and institutions. So in that sense, we both kind of agree entirely. Obviously, we come from different places from in the context of how we source our moral and ethical principles. I go to a metaphysical place in the context of being a Christian. That's how I anchor it and make sense of it. But the actual moral fruit, if you like, that we're both out there trying to further and arguing for are almost identical. I mean, he makes a great case for the importance of freedom and reciprocity and fairness, which map very easily onto the framework of Christian moral reasoning. And so I was actually quite refreshed. I don't want to ruin the show by agreeing too much with Alex, but it's nice to have a subject matter expert on liberalisms, as he is, have actually a pretty nuanced and respectful understanding of the Judeo-Christian role in the genealogy of liberalisms, you know, through people like John Locke and Adam Smith and others.
If I'm going to locate the difference between us, I think it would be that you and I are both kind of like thumbs up on liberalism as a political doctrine.
Right.
Freedom, tolerance, fairness, material provisions, that kind of stuff, I think we're going to be in heated agreement on. Where I think we differ is whether it's a standalone and a sufficiently robust moral or, if you like, spiritual or existential framework.
Right.
And you're going to say no, and I'm going to say, yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I feel like, for me, the idea that you can ground an ethical framework without an objective reference point that's outside of the system, I just think that the idea of good and evil has to be, for me, for it to be stable and robust and able to sustain ideas like intrinsic human dignity and universal human equality and these sorts of things needs to come from a place that isn't subject to human opinion and doesn't drift or change with time. And so we would anchor our ethics differently, even though I think our ethics, the fruit of it, is actually almost identical in many ways.
I'll get your reaction to that in a sec, Alex, but just tell me what not liberalism looks like in this world so that we can get a better understanding of what liberalism itself is.
Sure. In this world of ours right now, so what I want to do for my new project, so I wrote the liberalism book, now I want to look at non and post-liberalism, and I'm going to travel around to countries that are kind of aggressively calling themselves non or post-liberal, and I just spent the last couple months in Hungary. And I came off with a favorable impression, this isn't going to be a hit job, and I was speaking to its elites in Orbán's party, Viktor Orbán, the so-called authoritarian. So here's a difference that would be very striking for liberals, is that they're famously pro-family, anti-immigration policy.
Anti-immigration policy. Pro-family.
Yeah, that's right. And they give all these tremendous incentives to have families for young married couples. If you're a young married family under 30 and you have one, and you have to be married, and you have one child, then the woman pays no income tax for the rest of her life. It's only 15%, but still, that's not nothing. Two kids and you get some very attractive home loan incentives. Three kids and you get a minivan, or you get a deal on a minivan, and that's not a joke. You can't get married if you're gay, and you can't adopt if you're gay. I talked to so many of the elites there, and they all made the same point. They said, look, we're not going to coerce gay people. We're not going to forbid them from living how they want. Orbán himself says love is love. But he says, while we're not going to coerce these people, we are ready and willing and enthusiastic even to positively discriminate for the kinds of families and people that we want in our country to signal who is a true Hungarian. That is a non-liberal conception. There is an idea of what it means to be a thriving Hungarian in this case, and they're going to throw honor and money at it, and they're going to make it happen. In a liberal state, that wouldn't be possible. If we wanted to bump our natality rate, we would give out baby bonuses, we would fund the hell out of daycares, something that everyone can use, if they're single, if they're married, if they're gay, if they're not. But they have a very programmatic idea of what it means to be a family, and they're doing that.
Does that mean because Hungary is illiberal, the state can dictate what kind of place they want, but Australia and similar countries are smaller liberal, so our state doesn't shape? We just get out of the way and leave people to do their own thing? Or does liberalism shape the culture in its own way?
100%. So liberalism, it's as potent an ideology as any around. This is a very difficult question, so let me be simple. Liberalism will not tell you how to live your private life. That's its central calling card. But liberalism definitely has strong ideas and strong political and moral education around what it means to be a good citizen.
So strong that we don't even know we're succumbing to its pull.
Correct. I mean, that's the great trick of the devil, right? And you make it seem like he or liberalism is actually omnipresent but invisible. Listen, I wrote a small essay called Liberalism as Mob Boss. A mob boss never gets his hands dirty, right, actually doing the killing. He commands his capos, his lieutenants to do that. Ditto with the liberal state in an important respect. It doesn't tell you how to live. It can be hands-off, but that's in a sense because liberal ideas have colonized, if you like to use a kind of an aggressive metaphor, the background culture of liberal democracies. So that work, it's like an AI assistant. It's working 24/7 in the background without you recognizing it. So the state can be all cool and neutral, but in fact, the cultural formative power is going on, is just grinding behind the scenes. So it's a very interesting place for liberalism to be. Officially, it endorses nothing in terms of how to live a good life. Civil society, though, definitely skews towards certain kinds of lifestyles being preferred over others. Max, I'll hand over to you because this is your jam.
Yeah, and this is, I think, a really important comment from Alex. And this is actually what distinguishes him and a very small minority of liberalism scholars, because they understand what I also believe to be the case, that you know, liberalism is not some neutral force or neutral system of thinking or neutral design. There's always first principles at play. And, you know, I like Aristotle's definition of metaphysics. He just says metaphysics is about first principles. And so, you know, as Aldous Huxley said, you can have bad metaphysics or good metaphysics, but what you can't have is no metaphysics. Mm-hmm. There's always inbuilt first principles at play. And I think good liberal scholars and good, you know, proponents of and agents of liberalism, as I like to think all of us are, and we more and more of us should be, need to understand that there's always some endpoint, there's always some conception of where we want to be going. There are ideals here that we believe in. We don't need to run away from those and pretend like our liberalism is amoral or even apolitical in that sense. So when you look through the history of liberalisms and the different strands of it, of which there are so many, there are people like you know, John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham, they want to optimize for happiness and utility. And then there are people like Isaiah Berlin, who their ideal is social cohesion. And then, of course, John Rawls, who's more on about fairness and justice. Now, these are all, in my view, as a Christian, really worthy and important objectives for a society to have. But I think to do it well, we need to be clear that these are intrinsic goods. Now, obviously, different people are going to disagree on why they're intrinsic goods, but I think at least if we can get to the point that we agree on this kind of body of goods that, you know, Alex and I really do, then we can at least buy into them as worthy objectives of our society and work towards them, even if we think they grow out of different soil. If the fruit is common, then we can get on with the project of nation building and living alongside people that we fundamentally disagree with in how we see, you know, some of the other questions of life.
But if we're all shaped by liberalism and you both agree that liberalism delivers fruits, who cares whether or not we know the process?
But here, let me add a little bit of friction. Let's see if we can
disagree more.
If we get right, okay, this is a little, we're sitting too nicely together.
Okay.
All right. So I think one of your criticisms of liberalism is that it's parasitic in some important respect, and it's claiming a prior and objective moral framework, Christianity, and it sort of spurns it and forgets about it. And we're only 150 years out of that history when liberalism has kind of like kicked away the ladder from itself and it's like, no, we're standing on our own 2 feet.
Right.
But I take it that given enough time and given a loss of historical memory and cultural practice of Christianity widespread, you believe, I think, that even the political liberal ideas that we cherish will become more and more precarious, less and less secure because they've been unmoored from an objective theistic foundation. Now, when I hear that, I'm skeptical, and I'm going to put this in a polemical way because I want to hear from you. Mm. When I hear that argument coming at me, I'm like, dude, the 19th century called and wants its argument back. That's my feeling about that. Namely, it's like a Dostoevsky thing. It's like, if no God, everything is permitted. And then I just don't get that, because then it feels like theists are looking at liberals like me, or non-theistic liberals like me, and just saying that your morality is like kind of second order, or it's weakly held, or something like that. And that feels like a misdescription of my own commitments that I can't get on board with. So how would you reframe that for me?
Yes. Okay, this is good. We can disagree a little bit more. I think, first of all, it's worth noting that yes, there are non-theistic liberals, but there are also theistic
liberals. Definitely. Oh, yeah. Right. 100%.
Yeah.
I should have said that.
No.
Yes.
No. Yeah.
You.
Yes, exactly. I'm a good example of that. So I think you're right. Your characterization of my thinking as being concerned about the philosophical grounding, if you like, for non-theistic liberal ideals, I do agree with that. It's put well, actually, by a mentor of mine, a guy called Oz Guinness. He talks about the metaphor he uses is the cut flower society, you know, this idea that modern liberalisms have grown out of, in no small part, Judeo-Christian moral soil.
Right, right. That's smart.
Yeah, and once metaphor. You cut the flowers off, they're beautiful and you can enjoy them for a while. But
2 weeks tops.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's an end point to how long these cut flowers can survive, or certainly at least thrive. So, look, I think certainly in a theological and a philosophical sense, I do have concerns about the capacity for non-theistic moral reasoning to anchor universal moral ideals. Mm. And so, yeah, I think that's just where that's just an impasse.
Where we break.
Yeah, where we break. But where I think there is middle ground is that I would still much rather people that don't share my theological views or don't share my faith, I would still much rather them, you know, grounding their ethical views and undergirding their moral reasoning in an intentional and proactive way, in the way that you call on people to do. I think that's in a much better place, at least if we can all agree on the kind of flowers that we need to make this society work. I mean, it might be coming across too much like a synthesizer and a reconciler, but I think that is a good and worthy project, notwithstanding concerns that I have philosophically. But certainly I don't agree with some of those critiques that might have been handed down to non-theistic liberals in the past, that it's somehow second-order morality or second-rate. It makes for second-rate citizens or anything like that. I think anyone with half a brain can see that, you know, you certainly don't need to be a Christian to be a good person, and there are plenty of Christians that are far from that.
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. We are looking at our culture, saturated as it is with choice and individualism, or liberalism, you might say. Is it the 21st century's version of liberation, or is it a freedom trap? We are with Max Jagannathan, and we are with Alex Lefebvre. Max, you say freedom can be a trap, and your evidence is this famous jam experiment where a psychologist set up a supermarket store one day with only 6 flavors, the next day with 24 jams. When there were 24, there were far more customers, there was a bigger crowd with more choice, but when there were only 6 flavors, those customers actually bought and enjoyed more jam. From the small display, choice paralyzed rather than liberated, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just a disclaimer quickly, I'm not for a second saying that because of our choice anxiety, that we should be limiting freedom and limiting choice in a governmental sense. But this is where my book really tries to zero in on not so much freedom in a political context, but freedom in a personal sense, in our private lives. And this idea that we can, I think, deify and valorize the idea of freedom because so many people fought so hard for it to get it into our laws and our institutions and our systems of government, which I think is a good and important thing. And we still don't have anywhere near enough of that globally. But that doesn't mean we can just control C and control V, this idea of freedom, into every aspect of life. So don't get me wrong. I think there are aspects of life where, you know, more choice is always good. You know, we talk about, you know, medical treatment that's available to us. But I think sometimes we would do well to regulate our own choice to avoid that kind of paralysis and anxiety when a market society necessarily is there to optimize for profit making and runs on supply-demand principles. And sometimes that will offer us up choices that aren't necessarily in keeping with the deeper aspects of human flourishing, things like relationality and connection and reciprocity and fairness and these sorts of things. And so the market's not going to help us if it's a genuinely free market, and untethered liberalism is not going to help us either. We've kind of got to get alongside one another and limit choice where it's sensible to do so. And something like having 24 varieties of jam and spending an extra however many minutes and then being less likely to buy it anyway is just a very kind of simple and, you know, pithy example, if you like. But I think it does speak to, you know, how many options we have out there to what we live stream and our subscriptions and our, you know, podcasts and our apps and our phones. And I'm not saying for a second that we should regulate against those choices publicly or regulatorily, but I am saying we should regulate against them for ourselves and our personal lives so we can get on with focusing on the things that matter most, you know, the people we love in our lives, things that give us meaning and purpose, helping those that are disadvantaged and so forth.
What do you think, Alex?
Is there a sweet spot jam-wise? One jam? One jam you're not good with.
One jam I'm not good.
Three jams? Like, is it
yeah.
You're trying to hit some median. Not you, sorry, this is personalizing. You're not the jam czar. But the idea is that you're trying to get away from a disabling amount of choice that renders people into kind of like anxiety-ridden messes without criteria to distinguish between apricot and apricot light.
Right.
But then you do want a sufficient number of choice for people to be able to realize genuine preference.
Yeah, that's right. And I get that that's tricky. And I'm not for a second saying that therefore the answer is we should have less jam. I'm more than happy with the 25 or 30 or 50 or 200 jam options out there. The reason I think the study is helpful, and I think this is why they carried it out, I don't think they had any great passion for jam supply regulation. I think the purpose of the study was to show that more choice and more time spent choosing in all aspects of life is not always better for us in a broader context. So it's really up to us. I'm not saying the market should be regulated for this. I think it's just a window into a deep truth about human anthropology that more options are not always better for us. And so choice anxiety is a genuine thing, and we can inoculate against it if we're proactive and intentional about how we live and how we carry ourselves.
What do you think, Alex?
Look, it's very rare that a liberal will fetishize choice as such. Very few liberals that I know, maybe libertarians, but even still, it becomes almost nonsensical, the utterance that I value choice and freedom in and of itself as an objective good. No, we want choice and freedoms to be able to determine the kinds of life that suit us, that allow us to live well and authentically.
Or die on our own terms.
Or die on our own terms, sure. To enable us to make the kinds of life decisions we find most appropriate to us. So that, I think, liberalism is not, that's not a fair attack on liberalism. But where I do think it's much more interesting and where it gets at something very true and where liberalism is vulnerable is, look, liberalism, like I was saying before, liberalism and liberal governments don't publicly endorse any particular way of life as the best way of life. A Christian does, manifestly. What does it mean to be a Christian except for a follower of Christ? There's your ideal. It has the sanction of divinity, and it has the approval and refinement of 2,000 years of doctrine and practice. Why on earth wouldn't we follow that if we're a Christian? And what liberalism does is it throws away the baby with the holy water, as it were, in the sense that it just says there are no publicly approved models. So everyone, and this is kind of the romantic liberalism, everyone then has to kind of invent their own moral ideal of what it means to live like a good Alex or a good Max. And that's dicey because people are dumb, and so in some important respect, people aren't able and equipped to make those decisions, and they shouldn't spurn officially sanctioned models quite so quickly as they do. And that is, I think, where liberalism might be vulnerable.
So why are you a liberal then?
Because I think the alternative is, so it's the thing about democracy, it's the worst except for all the rest. Because the alternative then is to have officially publicly sanctioned moralities and then organize our states and our education around that, which for me violates some prior very important principles of freedom, self-determination, respect for persons and the like, which are liberal goods.
Which we both agree
so
on.
So we're stuck then.
Yeah.
We're stuck then in a culture, and this is why people like us write books. We're stuck in a culture that has inherited a Christian culture that has repudiated at a public state level, and now we inhabit the aftermath of that decision. We don't want to go back to a emphatically a theocracy, or what people talk about now as integralism, integrating the church and the state. We find that pernicious. But we also see the loss of individualizing models of the good life to just ordinary people like you and me, and we just don't have the resources often to make intelligent decisions about that.
And Alex, just again, describe what some illiberal societies look like. You've already described the kind of MAGA countries of the world, Modi in India, Trump's America, of course, you mentioned Hungary, but there are other forms of illiberalism, countries with different conceptions of family values, countries which have just different orientations on all sorts of things. Some examples?
Let me do the annoying professor of philosophy thing. Just one step back. Okay, Aristotle and Confucius, different times, different places, it set the rest of political philosophy in motion. They said, basically, we have states or we have political communities. And then they asked the most basic question, why? Why do we have these things? Aristotle says, look, it's good to have security and it's good to have material prosperity, but there has to be something higher. And he concludes, book one of The Politics, that the whole point of the polis, of the city, is to promote the good life. Now, what the good life is can vary according to whatever civilization you're in. For the Greeks, it once meant be like Achilles, then it meant be like Socrates, then it meant be like someone more plausible, like Alexander, for example. But then Christianity took it over with be like Christ, and Confucianism have be like Confucius, and you just go from there. And so each society that's not liberal and wants to impose a particular or recommend a particular way of life is going to tailor it according to whatever set of values of that place. Liberal democracies don't and can't do that. What happens, say liberals, is that you had, let's say, in Reformation Europe, you had the wars of religion. Why? Because you had confessional faiths regarding the other side as damned, and that unleashed a particularly devastating kind of warfare. And liberals said, no, we cannot do this. We have to have the state abstain from those kinds of judgment and create kind of civic spaces where people can get along. So Australia, we have civic ideals. We have mateship and that kind, but that's not a prescription as to how to live your private life. Whereas these other non-liberal kinds of places, some do it very aggressively. China has re-education centers in the western part of its countries. They're not screwing around. That is a strongly teleological good life idea. We want Chinese to be like that. Let's put them in these places and make them like that.
The social credit system.
The social credit system is another. But then you have some lighter touch ones, like Hungary, for example, incentivizes good ways of life, but it doesn't coerce ways of life that it disapproves of. But in any case, those wouldn't fly in a liberal regime because we don't want the state in the business of telling us how to live.
Interesting. And in other communities around the world, clan or tribe maybe.
Absolutely.
These are other examples of illiberal.
Yeah, and they would, and listen, liberalism does certain values really, really well, I think. Things like freedom, fairness, tolerance, reciprocity, irony, a kind of certain kind of lightness. I think liberals are good at that. At least until progressivism came. But let's bracket that convo for later. You can come. Sorry, I opened up a Pandora's box to hit me with later, but you can do that. But I think liberal ethics and liberal morality is really bad at other stuff. If you talk about values like loyalty, self-sacrifice, harmony, order, all of those things aren't great liberal values, but they are absolutely genuine human excellences. Piety, faith, it's just liberals kind of suck at those things. And we push them to the sides and we don't put them at the center of our moral universe. And then these other cultures are going to put things like loyalty, faith, whatever, at the heart of themselves. No one way of life is the ultimate super sweet way of life that will combine and accommodate all these goods. There's tragic choices. Liberals made a choice. Christians made a choice. And they doubled down on a core set of values around them. Christians understand love in a way that I would never. I know what the word agapic love means, but to feel it in my bones, I have no idea. It seems nuts to me. But salute that you can do it. Like, amazing. But the idea of kind of non-preferential love, that seems bananas to me. But I get it as a human excellence. It's just not something liberals can do.
Max, can you explain what Alex means and what he doesn't understand with this word agape love?
I think he understands much more than he realizes he does. I mean, I think I agree. I agree.
That's the most Christian comment I've heard this week.
I agree entirely with his critique of what, you know, non-theistic liberalism might struggle with. But his point actually makes a strong case for liberalism as a good in itself in the context of a political and governmental system, an operating system for government, because it shows that we actually need people of all different kinds of theistic and non-theistic beliefs at the table to speak into the public square to contribute to our moral fabric. And so he just made a really good case for where, you know, Christians and Christianity, and Christians when they're acting like Christians, can make a meaningful contribution, can offer the moral equipment and some of the moral horsepower to the universal public square that can be helpful with that.
But doesn't our culture discourage that, or at least sections of it? Keep your rosaries off my ovaries?
Yeah, which I think that instinct to exclude people of faith, and I'm not just talking about Christians, I'm talking about people of all faiths and no faith, to exclude people just based on the fact that they anchor their moral frameworks in the transcendent, I think that's hugely problematic.
What about when they bring that interpretation of the transcendent into policy that affects a non-believer?
Yeah, and that's why those arguments and debates should be happening out in the open in the discourse. But the idea that someone of faith should check their faith at the door is, for me, as ridiculous as asking, you know, someone who's agnostic or someone who's atheistic to check their atheism at the door. Like, there's no neutral here. We're not trying to get people to all believe the same thing. That's just not how humankind is going to work. And so I think there is a level of pluralism that perhaps people of faith, including Christians, need to get more comfortable with the reality of. You know, we're not, the purpose of this is not to get everyone Christian. That might be the project and the mission at a theological level, but that's not the purpose of government. That's not the purpose of, you know, governmental institutions and laws. That's a project for the Christian church to work towards. But we all need to be at the table contributing morally and ethically whatever we can so we can live alongside each other. And so I think the list that Alex listed off of all of the things that the liberalism does well, the things that it doesn't do well, that just makes the case even more so that, and I can only speak for the Judeo-Christian moral framework, that it should be one of the voices at the table. I think that's a good and appropriate thing, and we should have those debates and discussions. You know, I don't think it's an accident that Abraham Lincoln, a Christian, when he declared democracy to be government of the people, for the people, and by the people, that he was actually quoting a Christian theologian and Bible scholar, John Wycliffe, who had just earlier made the point that, yes, that is democracy, but for democracy to work well, it works really well if you can get some of these Christian ideals into the hearts and minds of people. And he obviously had a view that, you know, like I do, that Christianity is true, but these ideals of self-sacrifice and of love and of charity and relationality and all of those sorts of things, he correctly identified, I think, that liberal democracies, regardless of what people believe in them, can do better and can benefit from some of these Christian ideals.
Can I add one thing here? So it's really interesting to try to identify what kind of conversation we're having. So we can criticize liberalism in two different ways. You can criticize liberalism for not living up to its ideals. So liberalism talks a huge game about fairness, yet we live in shockingly unequal societies. And so lefty critics are often going to make that reproach to liberalism. It's too tied up with the market, with capitalism. And so we need kind of either a more robust distributive apparatus or something more aggressively socialist. But that's basically an intra-liberal criticism of liberalism. It's saying, hey, liberalism, you want to be fair, look at Nancy Pelosi's stock portfolio, what the hell? She's out-earning Warren Buffett year on year. Right. This isn't on. She's not a true liberal. So all that stays within the liberal household, though. But when I hear critics from the right make criticisms of liberalism, I hear something very different and maybe more interesting, but more frightening for me, which is that these critics say that the ideals of liberalism itself are ignoble, that to live a life of tolerance or freedom, which is sort of what you are suggesting in parts, if you go too hard on it, that's simply not a viable or a remunerative ideal to live your life by, and better to turn to some other alternative, objectively true in your eyes, value system that would give us a firm grounding. So that's an extra liberal criticism of liberalism.
No, that's right. And I accept that. And I accept that criticism of the criticisms that can come from the right. I think part of the challenge is, and I see this on both sides of this debate, I don't think a lot of conservatives fully understand how to be for liberalism and be a conservative.
Yeah.
And I think at the same time, a lot of people for liberalism don't quite, you know, understand that liberalism doesn't necessarily have to be a comprehensive ideology. It can actually just be a system of government and institutions, and then we can bring our moral reasoning to that. So I think there's a lack of understanding of theistic moral frameworks from some people who are for liberalism, and I think there's a lack of understanding how conservative political thinking and social thinking and theological thinking can quite reasonably and easily fit if we're willing to show some nuance and sophistication into the broader liberal project. I don't want to just be reductive and say it's all about a lack of nuance, but I think a lot of it is. And I think part of why this conversation's going the way it's going is this is what happens when you get nuance on at the table. It's probably why we're not disagreeing as much as we could do. Because when you look more closely and you unpack it a bit more, there's clearly fundamental disagreements at a first principle level here. But there's so much more moral, ethical and philosophical horsepower that is pulling in the same direction, even with the disagreements notwithstanding.
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. We are looking at our culture, saturated as it is with liberalism, you might say. We are with Max Jagannathan and we are with Alex Lefebvre. So, Alex, tell me more about this idea that, you know, when the Trump phenomenon first came along, small L liberals would make fun of them. They'd go to Trump rallies and go, look at these weird people with their weird views. That's unhelpful and dangerous in your view, yeah?
Yep, terrifically so, yeah. The thing that's going to bring down the liberal order is liberal smugness.
And it does.
It does. It's the worst thing. In a culture of egalitarianism, which we all live in, to be smug and condescending is just the most unstrategic thing you could possibly
do. The ABC is accused of being smug. And what is more an epitome of the liberal order, the small L liberal order, than an institution like the ABC, an arm of the Australian state? And am I missing something?
No, you're right. You're right. Listen, so about the post-liberals, the first thing I think all liberals need to know about post-liberals, people who are repudiating, is that they know way more about us than we know about them.
You're not being sarcastic.
I'm not being sarcastic. No. Sorry, zero sarcasm there.
No.
So to go and tell a post-liberal, hey, women have rights or something, like there's equality between the gender, like that is just the you're not engaging at all on their plane. They know this. Post-liberals know liberals way better than we know them. And to try to have a conversation with them will never be about supplying some piece of information about the liberal puzzle that has somehow eluded them from since they've been born till now. That's nuts. Because if I'm right about my book, it's that they swim in the same liberal water as I do. So that's what I think is most pernicious to our liberal order. And this comes back to what I was saying about the two most important and defining features of what it means to be liberal. It means to be free, okay, but also means to be generous. Now, generous doesn't just mean pocketbook, Sweden style, let's tax the hell out of stuff. It also means hermeneutic or interpretive generosity, to not leap down someone's throat, to not cancel them if they stray one inch out of official morality.
Right.
Because that stuff is so counterproductive. It's wrong. It's morally wrong, first of all. But second, it's deeply unstrategic.
So post-liberals, MAGA people, are angry at the hypocrisy of liberals because they say they are...
They say they're tolerant and...
In fact, the most likely to be intolerant.
Go on Blue Sky, you'll see how far the Twitter alternative for liberals is just the most place where you get canceled for saying anything outside one inch of correct sanctioned opinion. So yeah, I definitely think that. I think that that is a part of the fire. Listen, if I could wish a politician into existence, and here I'm going to get canceled myself, but just bear with me, dear listener, for about 15 more seconds. The one I would want to be a politician reincarnated for liberals right now is Bill Clinton, minus the sexual monstrosity and all that stuff. The reason why is that what Bill Clinton and also Reagan were really, really good at doing was making people feel that they liked them. Does that make sense? Not that you liked Clinton, but that Clinton liked you.
Right.
And it's that warmth, that recognition, that being seen, that being affirmed, that liberals need more than anything else. If you appoint judgy, correct opinion people, we're cooked.
Even in Australia, which has had this idea that we're immune from extremism or illiberalism. And now we are seeing One Nation beat the Liberals in national opinion polls consistently.
Yeah. So, okay, this is a really, really interesting phenomenon. I think, you know where to find me, Liberal Party consultants. I just think Liberal Party, capital L Liberal Party, is in deep, deep trouble in this country because they're pinched between two movements. If the Labour government occupies the center reasonably well, then Liberals can't continue to claim a constituency because the right is outflanking them precisely on ideas of what it means to be a good Australian, anti-immigration stuff. So you have, on the one hand, a far-right party now is stepping up to the mantle of telling Australians what it means to be a good Australian, and then you have a Labour Party colonizing the centre. Liberals have no space between those two alternatives.
And would you say that it's only a matter of time before the shaky foundation the Labour Party is on may crumble as well if they don't take a more populist approach to the left? Max?
Yeah, look, I think, I mean, I agree with Alex on his read of the political landscape. I think there's a pretty big reorganisation and restructure happening. I also think for some time now, going back about 10 years, there's been a structural problem with the primary votes of both major parties. I also, you know, just personally, to out myself, I remain of the view that Australia does best with its two-party system holding in the way that it has over the last, you know, 126 years or so. But I don't think any political party is immune. I know this government is sitting very comfortably politically in a sense, but I mean, you can tell just from the comments of Labour Party folks, right from the Prime Minister down, that they're not taking anything for granted. And there are Labour strategists and tacticians that are on the public record saying, you know, that big majority looks great in Parliament, but the primary vote's very low. I think I read an article the other day by a pundit who correctly said that never has a government had such a large majority that's still potentially quite politically vulnerable just under the surface. And so I think the big thing that's missing that speaks to the rise of One Nation in the polls, and I think we need to put that in perspective too. I think some of that is just coalition voters parking their vote out of disaffection because of some of the chaos over there. But even all of that to one side, I think the big thing that's missing that people are crying out for is that active sense of empathy and authenticity from the political class. And we see that when people, and you spoke about it earlier, Alex, when political leaders just write off particular groups or particular belief systems, or they get smug or self-righteous or triumphalist in any kind of way, that's kind of the end of the game. That's shooting yourself in the foot as a political leader. So what I think we need more in Australian politics is authentic empathy from political leaders across the board. And I think this might sound idealistic, that will re-centralise, you know, the political landscape and the political paradigm in a way that I think is more constructive and more representative.
Why did Liberals, sorry, a question if I can, why do you think Liberals became judgy and sanctimonious? Is it just, like, does the hegemon just become judgy at some point because they think they're invulnerable? Like, what's going on there?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, and now, of course, we're talking about Liberals in the left-right political spectrum.
Yeah,
small L Liberals, right?
Yeah, sorry.
I think, and going back to, you know, Liberals and post-Liberals, I think this is a really human problem. Like a universal human problem. And I don't think this is a left-wing thing or a right-wing thing, a conservative thing or a progressive thing, a theistic liberal or a non-theistic liberal thing. I think this is a deeply human problem that with any kind of influence, power, political comfort, people just can't be trusted with that. People can't be trusted with power for too long or too much of it. And sooner or later, if there's any kind of ideological ascendancy in a political sense, we do tend to bring the house down on ourselves, regardless of which side of that you're on, which interestingly and implicitly remakes the case for the broader project of governmental liberalism, that it's important that because that is the case and human beings, and this is obviously quite a Christian thing to say, human beings are intrinsically broken, we can't be trusted with power, that we should have a system of government where power is limited, government is limited, and we can throw people out whenever we feel the need to as a populace. And even that has its problems, but as Alex and many others have said, it might be, you know, the worst one out there, except for all the other ones.
Hmm. And yet you've argued, Max, that too much freedom can leave us empty. So I guess a final question to you both is, what does being genuinely free, a genuinely free life actually look like?
Look, it is a difficult question. I don't want to just give some cookie cutter response, but you know, as a follower of Jesus, Scripture and what I believe is quite clear that freedom, at its best, when it leads to flourishing, it's mediated through purpose, and so it's about considering the purpose for which we were made, the purpose for which we are here, and the conditions under which we flourish best and optimize for the flourishing of those around us. And so freedom in that sense, you know, for me is really about not so much doing whatever I want, whenever I want, however I want, but it's investing in relationships and relationality, which is core, you know, for followers of Jesus. And not to be reductive about it, but, you know, the words of Jesus are quite clear when he was asked, what are we meant to do? What's the rule? He said, go and love God with everything you've got and go and love other people with everything you've got. And so I say, you know, invest in relationships for those who have a faith, a Christian faith or another faith. Your relationship with God, obviously, is critically important. But secondarily, and for everyone, regardless of our faith position, investing in our relationships with one another can always be and is always, you know, a path to flourishing and to using our freedom well. So freedom at its best is mediated through purpose. And for me as a Christian, that's about relationship. And it's interesting that I think any good reading of the liberal project when it's working well is that liberalism really is about a series of interlocking and inextricable relationships between the people. And so that actually is a nice little overlap and a point of harmony, I think, between Christian moral reasoning and the broader political and governmental liberal project.
So I agree entirely with Max minus the Jesus bit for me. I think the frame is exactly right. And that's the freedom trap, right? If freedom is an end in itself, that's not that's not a good place to be. And you need some ulterior, anterior, something else above and beyond it. So let me end by approving or siding with the second most famous atheist of the modern age, Karl Marx is first, Sigmund Freud is second. And he said, the meaning of life, love and work, work and love, that's all there is. And that would be my answer as a liberal, but that's a secular version of Marx's answer. It's a recovery of meaning and purpose outside of a transcendent frame and putting it within the context of this life. And for a poor liberal like me, that's the best we can hope for.
Is that in itself transcendent or?
No, I know. I think we need to reserve the word transcendent for transcendent things. I think otherwise we start thinking and talking mushy and we can't actually recognize. Liberals want to see everyone as a liberal in waiting. That's what liberals often do at our worst. And to say that our system of ethics is transcendent, I feel it does that move. Whereas I want to recognize Max as having something genuinely different, valuable, and also a little freaky from my point of view.
You'll do us out of a job if we can't be mushy, but it's been a most enjoyable hour. Alex, Max, thank you both very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Max Jagannathan is Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Public Christianity. His book, The Freedom Trap. And Alex Lefebvre is a Professor of Politics and Philosophy at the University of Sydney. His book, Liberalism as a Way of Life. That's it for God Forbid this week. Thanks to producer Amanda Roberts, sound engineer Roy Huberman. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.